I want to continue in volume 2, taking up at August the 7th, 1899. This morning my beloved Jesus would not come. After much waiting, finally he came. My confusion and annihilation were such that I was unable to tell him anything. Jesus said, "The more you annihilate yourself and come to know your nothingness, the more my humanity, unleashing rays of light, will communicate my virtues to you." Now, this is an extremely important point. Luke 14:11 says, "He who humbles himself will be exalted." Now, the Lord wants us to go beyond humility into absolute nothingness, because that's where freedom is. Okay. And so he says, the more you go back into that nothingness and come to know your nothingness, the more he can release his rays of light and communicate his virtues to us. So Louisa said, "Lord, I'm so bad and ugly as to be horrifying to myself. What must I be before you?" And Jesus said, "If you are ugly, I will make you beautiful." And in the act of saying this, he sent a light from himself to my soul, and it seemed that he would communicate his beauty to it. And then embracing me, he began to say, "How beautiful you are, but beautiful of my own beauty." Therefore, what he's communicating to her is divine beauty, not human beauty, because it's the soul you're talking about, and human beauty in the soul wouldn't be any use. "So this is why I am drawn to love you," he said, "because my own beauty is in you." Louisa said, "Who can say how confused I remained more than ever, but may all be for his glory." August the 8th, 1899 is about resignation. Very important. He continues to make himself seen for just a little and almost angry with people. "As much as I prayed him to pour his bitterness into me, it was impossible. And without paying attention to what I was saying, he told me, 'This is one of the keys in the divine will. Resignation absorbs all that can be painful and disgusting to one's nature and renders it sweet.'" So what we want to violently reject will change when we resign ourselves to the cross and to God's will. "And since my being," Jesus said, "is peaceful and tranquil in such a way that no matter what may happen in heaven or on earth, it cannot receive even the slightest breath of disturbance." Now here he's coming back to this other key, which is terribly important. The disturbance which blocks everything. He said, "I cannot receive even the slightest breath of disturbance. Resignation has the power of grafting these very virtues of mine into the soul." A resigned soul is always at rest. And not only herself, but she also allows me to rest peacefully within her. So I want to give you some scriptures for rest. Psalm 37, verse 7. Psalm 55, verse 6. Psalm 62, which says over and over again, "Rest in God, my soul." Psalm 116, verse 7. And Psalm 132, verse 14. Now, August the 10th, 1899 is about justice and the fruits of justice. "This morning, my sweet Jesus came. He transported me outside of myself and then he disappeared. As he left me alone, I saw as though two candelabra of fire descending from heaven, which then divided into many pieces, formed many lightnings and much hail, and came down upon the earth, causing very great torment over plants and people. The horror and the vehemence of the thunderstorm was such that one could not even pray, and people could not manage to withdraw into their homes. Who can say how frightened I was? So I began to pray in order to placate the Lord, And as he came back, I saw that he was carrying an iron rod in his hand. Oops. Which had a ball of fire at the top. Well, Revelation 12, 5 and 19, 15 and Psalm 2 all say that he will rule with a rod of iron. That means a law that will not change. And this is what's wrong in our society today. They have changed. They've thrown God's laws out and they expect all laws to adapt to where they're at. But that's not what happens. God's law doesn't change. What God says is eternally. And then Jesus told me, Louisa said, my justice has been withheld for a long time, and with reason it wants to take revenge on creatures who have dared to destroy every justice within themselves. Ah, yes, I find no justice in man. He has counterfeited himself completely in his words, in his works, and in his steps. Everything is deception, everything is fraud, everything is injustice, which have penetrated into his heart in such a way that inside and out he's a bilge of vices. Poor man, how you have reduced yourself, Jesus said. So first of all, I want to give you Micah 6:8. This is what the Lord asks of you. Only this, that you would act justly, that you would love tenderly, and you would walk humbly with your God. That's a summary of all the teaching of the prophets. I want to give you Revelation 6 verses 1 to 2. And I want to give you Isaiah 59 verses 1 to 13. So notice why justice is coming upon the earth. It's because we are unjust to each other. If we loved one another, love would come down from heaven and make us all more heavenly citizens. But all this injustice and all this deception and all the rest of it absolutely makes hell on the earth. Now, he is most likely referring to the release of Marxist communism and atheism upon the world. The French Revolution established atheism in Europe and is responsible for the terrible deterioration of the human race. Okay. So injustice and deceit are the work of Satan, and justice, truth and simplicity are the marks of Jesus. So we will know if we have slipped into a different kingdom. While saying this, Jesus was swinging the rod he had in his hand in the act of wounding man. I said to him, Lord, what are you doing? And he said, don't fear. Do you see this ball of fire? It will cause fire, but it will only strike the evil. The good will receive no harm. Now there I want to give you Revelation 7:3, Revelation 9:4, and Revelation 11:18. Now in 7:3 and 9:4, the good people were marked so that the chastisement wouldn't come to them. And in Revelation 11:18, the Lord said, I will destroy the destroyers of the earth. So that's what he's saying here, that the chastisement will be selective. It will only strike the evil, the good will not receive them. And Louisa responded, ah, Lord, who's good, she said. Now, in Mark 10:18, Jesus said, nobody is good except God alone. She said, we're all evil. I beg you not to look at us, but at your infinite mercy. And in this way, you will be placated for everyone. After this, he added, the daughter of justice is truth. I am eternal truth. That's John 14:6. I am the way, the truth and the life. And I do not deceive, nor can I deceive. In the same way, the soul who possesses justice makes truth shine in all her actions. Therefore, since she knows by experience the true light of truth, if someone wants to deceive her, since that light which she feels within herself is missing, she immediately recognizes the deceit. Now, one of the signs of a holy person is that they can see through all the fluff that people throw up in when they're trying to deceive others, and they can touch the truth right at its centre. A very good example of this is in Acts chapter 4, where Peter and John are on trial for having cured a cripple. And they're being ordered not to preach in the name of Jesus. And Peter was touched by the Holy Spirit, and he spoke to the Sanhedrin and he said, listen, you're saying all kinds of things to us, but you've actually put us on trial for healing a cripple, he said. Is that the state that we've arrived at? The Sanhedrin were terrified that these men were becoming more and more and more like Jesus. So if truth is the daughter of justice, then it so happens that with this light of truth, the soul deceives neither herself nor her neighbour, nor can she be deceived. John 8:32. The fruit produced by this justice and by this truth is simplicity, which is another quality of my being. Being simple, meaning uncomplicated. So much so that I penetrate everywhere. There's nothing that can prevent me from penetrating inside of it. I penetrate into heaven and into the very abysses, into good and into evil. But my being, which is most simple, just like light is most simple, by penetrating even into evil, does not get dirty. What is more, it doesn't even receive the slightest shadow. In the same way, through justice and truth, gathering this beautiful fruit of simplicity within herself, the soul penetrates into heaven. She is then able to enter into the hearts and lead them to God, and she penetrates into everything that is good. And if she finds herself with sinners and sees the evil that they do, she does not get dirty because, being simple, she immediately brushes it off without receiving any harm. Simplicity is so beautiful that my heart is wounded at one gaze of a simple soul. Okay. She is the admiration of angels and of men. So I want to give you Matthew 18 verses 1 to 3. I want to give you Psalm 116 verse 6. And Psalm 119 verse 130. So now we come to August the 12th, 1899. Jesus transforms Louisa completely into himself and teaches her charity or divine love. And that's because God is love, 1 John 4:7. This morning, after he made me wait for some time, my adorable Jesus came telling me, my daughter, this morning I want to conform you completely to myself. I want you to think with my own mind. I want you to look with my own eyes. I want you to listen with my own ears, speak with my own tongue, work with my own hands, walk with my own feet, and love with my own heart. So there's complete identification. After this, Jesus united his senses mentioned above to mine, and I saw that he was giving me his own shape. So there you have your Galatians 2:20. I no longer live, Christ lives in me. Not only this, but he gave me the grace to make use of it as he did himself. Now that's the VIP bit. Not only was she made like him, but she was given the grace and the ability to actually use it and use it in the same way that Jesus did. And then he continued, great graces I am pouring into you, so make sure you keep them all. Because we've already dealt with messages in which the importance was in the way we respond to the grace that's given to us. Louisa said, I fear very much, O my beloved Jesus, in knowing myself all full of misery, that instead of doing good, I will make bad use of your graces. But what I fear the most is my tongue, that oftentimes makes me slip in charity towards my neighbour. Now, if you go to the book of Proverbs, there are 50 proverbs on the tongue alone. And one of them says that there is life and death in the power of the tongue, and those who use it must eat the fruit thereof. We murder people with the tongue more often than any other instrument. Jesus said, Do not fear. I myself will teach you the way that you must keep speaking with your neighbour. Now, James chapter 4 speaks about the tongue as well. Matthew 7 verses 1 to 5 also. Now, these are the lessons that Jesus gave her about speaking about the neighbour. 1. When you are told something about your neighbour, cast a gaze upon yourself and observe whether you are guilty of the same defect. For in that case, wanting to correct is simply wanting to make me indignant and to scandalize your neighbor. Second, if you see yourself free of the defect, rise then and try to speak as I would have. In this way, you will speak with my own tongue. By doing so, you will never fail in charity with your neighbor. On the contrary, with your words, you will do good to yourself and to your neighbor, and to me, you will give honor and glory. That takes a lot of wisdom. We'd have to pray hard for wisdom before you would think of correcting your neighbor. August the 13th, 1899, Jesus assumes the image of Louisa. Jesus continued to make himself seen this morning for just a little, always threatening to send chastisement. And as I would go about praying him to placate himself, he would escape me because he obviously wanted to chastise. The last time he came, he made himself seen crucified. I placed myself near him to kiss his most holy wounds, doing various adorations, and you find examples of this in the Hours of the Passion. But while I was doing this, instead of Jesus Christ, I saw my own image. I was surprised and I said, Lord, what am I doing? Am I doing the adorations to myself? This cannot be. But what she was seeing was that we've just been told in the last message that she has been identified with him. At that very instant, he changed into the person of Jesus Christ and he told me, don't be surprised that I have assumed your image. If I suffer in you continuously, what is the wonder that I have assumed your shape? Besides, is it not to make you an image of myself, that's Romans 8:29, that I make you suffer? In other words, to have complete identification with him as a co-redeemer. Louisa said, I remained all confused and Jesus disappeared. Okay. So August the 15th, 1899. So we come back again to this theological virtue of charity or caritas or agape and divine love. This morning, my most sweet Jesus came all festive, carrying a bundle of most graceful flowers in his hands. And placing himself in my heart, he would surround his head with those flowers, and then he would hold them in his hands, enjoying and delighting his whole self. While he was celebrating with these flowers, and it seemed he had made a great gain, he turned to me and he told me, My beloved, this morning I have come to place in order all the virtues of your heart. Now, if you go back to the beginning of your book, this whole journey into the divine will is the call of the creature to return to the order, the place and the purpose for which God created it. So here Jesus is coming now to put everything in order. Now that doesn't mean that Louisa is in disorder. It means that he's going to put a divine order on it, which is a different matter altogether. The other virtues may remain separate from one another, But charity or divine love binds and orders everything. This is like, if you like, connective tissue in the body. It holds all the organs together and keeps everything in its right place. So charity is what keeps the soul in all in order, divinely. Here is what I want to do to order charity. So Louisa said, "My soul and only good, how can you do this since I am so bad and full of defects and imperfections?" Isaiah 6, verses 1 to 6. If charity is in order, aren't these defects and sins disorder that keeps my soul all messy and upside down? And Jesus said, "I will purify everything, and charity will put everything in order." Besides, when I let a soul participate in the pains of my passion, there cannot be grave sins. At most, some venial involuntary defects. This is terribly important, because if we have voluntary sins in us, we cannot be in divine will. It's just that simple. 1 John 3:6. We can't do it. "But my love, being fire, will consume everything that is imperfect in your soul." So it seems that Jesus purified me and ordered all of me. And then he poured as though a rivulet of honey from his heart into mine. And with the honey, he watered all of my interior. I think that's an incredible mixture of images. In other words, he's trying to say that it was sweet. In such a way that everything that was in me remained orderly, united, and with the mark of charity. Now, if we have the mark of charity, we are citizens of heaven. When you go to Revelation 13, those who are in the choosing the wrong kingdom get the mark of the beast, and that tells you where they're going. After this, Louisa said, "I felt I was going out of myself into the vault of the heavens, together with my loving Jesus. It seemed that everything was in feast, heaven, earth and purgatory. All were inundated with a new joy and jubilation. Many souls were going out of purgatory and like bolts of lightning reaching heaven in order to be present at the feast of our Queen Mother. I too pushed myself through that immense crowd of people, angels, saints and souls from purgatory, which already occupied that new heaven. It was so immense that the heavens that we see compared to that one seemed a little whole to me. More so since I had the obedience of the confessor. But as I went about looking, I could see nothing but a most refulgent sun. God is light. 1 John 1:5. A most refulgent sun spreading its rays, which penetrated through me in such a way as to make me become like crystal. That means that the light could go completely through. There was nothing blocking the light. So she's become spiritualized. So much so that my little spots appeared very clearly, as well as the infinite distance that exists between the creator and the creature. So she's seeing reality as it really is, how great God is and how nothing we are. And not only that, but even at a level of relationship that Louisa has with the Lord, that we're extremely defective. More so, she says, since each one of those rays had its imprint, some delineated the sanctity of God, some of the purity of God, some the power of God, some of the wisdom of God, and some all the other virtues and attributes of God. So all these rays of light she was seeing were representing all the different attributes of God. So in seeing her nothingness, her miseries and her poverty, the soul would feel annihilated. And instead of looking, she would fall down on her face to the ground before the eternal sun, which nobody can face. So there I want to give you Revelation 1:16, where St. John, who was the favourite of Jesus' 12, who loved Jesus the most, was most intimate with him spiritually. He fell flat on his face in terror in seeing Jesus in glory. I want to give you 1 Chronicles 16:29. I want to give you Exodus 15:11, and I want to give you Isaiah 64 verses 1 to 2 and Hebrews 12:14. You can look them up yourself. What is more, Louisa said, in order to see the feast of our Queen Mother, one had to look from within that sun which represents God. So much did the Most Holy Virgin appear to be immersed in God. In fact, in looking from other points, one could see nothing. Now, while I was in this state of annihilation before the Divine Son, the baby Jesus, being held in the arms of the Queen Mother, told me, our Mother is in heaven. To you, I give the office of acting as my Mother on the earth. So this is a new stage for Louisa. Louisa is to live the fullness of Jesus' life on earth, and she's to imitate Blessed Mother as well. So now she has to be his mother on the earth. And since my life is continuously subject to scorns, poverty, pains, and the abandonment of men, and my mother, while being on the earth, was my faithful companion in all of these pains, not only this, but she tried to relieve me in everything as much as her strength was capable of. You too, acting as my mother, will keep me faithful company in all of my pains, suffering in my place as much as you can. And where you cannot reach, you will try to give me at least a refreshment. That is, to do something to give him souls. Know, however, that I want you all intent on me. So there's the all eyes on Jesus, okay? it's also Deuteronomy 6, 4 to 10. You're getting used to this, aren't you? To love the Lord with all your heart, soul, mind and being. I will be jealous, Jesus said, even of your breath, if you do not do it for me. And when I see that you are not all intent on contenting me, I'll give you no peace and no rest, like a child demanding attention from its mother. After this, Louisa said, I began to act as his mother. But how much attention was needed to make him content? My goodness. To see him content, one had to not even give a glance in any other place. Sometimes he wanted to sleep, or he wanted to drink, or he wanted to be cheered with caresses, and I had to be ready for anything that he wanted. So the image that's given to her is of a child who is demanding absolute attention from the mother. He would say to me, my mother, my head is hurting, please relieve me. And immediately I would check his head, and finding some thorns, I would remove them, and placing my arms beneath his head, I would make him rest. While I would make him rest, all of a sudden he would get up and he'd say, I feel a weight and a suffering in my heart, to the point where I feel I'm dying. Take a look and see what's there. And observing the interior of his heart, I found all the instruments of the passion. I removed them one by one, Louisa said, and I placed them in my own heart. She's nothing if she isn't very brave. Then, seeing him relieved, I began to caress him and kiss him, and I said to him, my sole and only treasure, you didn't even let me watch the feast of our Queen Mother, or listen to the first canticles that the angels and the saints sang when she entered paradise. And Jesus said, the first canticle they sang was the Hail Mary. Isn't that absolutely gorgeous? Because in the Hail Mary, there are the most beautiful praises, the greatest honours. And the joy they felt, the joy she felt in being the Mother of God is renewed. Therefore, let us recite it together to honour her. And when you come to paradise, I will let you find it as if you had recited it together with the angels and the saints for the first time in heaven. So she says it now, and he takes it as if she had been actually there. Now, that's the way with all of our divine will prayers, that the Lord allows you to enter in at a level where it's the same as if you were there at creation, you were there at redemption, and you were there with all the sanctification as well. It's an immense privilege. So we recited the first part of the Hail Mary together. Oh, how tender and moving it was to hail our Most Holy Mother together with her beloved Son. Each word he said carried an immense light through which one could understand many things about the Most Holy Virgin, but who can say them all, especially with my inability? Therefore, I pass over in silence. This is only volume 2. She won't be able to do that in the higher volumes. So August the 16th, 1899. Louisa continues to act as Jesus' earthly mother. Jesus continues to want me to act as his mother. He made himself seen as a most gracious little baby crying. And to calm his crying, holding him in my arms, I began to sing. It so happened that when I would be singing, he would stop crying. And when I wouldn't, he'd start crying again. I would rather have kept silent on what I was singing. First, because I don't remember everything, since I was outside of myself, and one can hardly remember all the things that happen. And also because I believe it doesn't make sense. But Lady Obedience, who is too demanding and won't give up, it's enough that she is making me do this. I don't know. They say that this Lady Obedience is blind, but to me it seems rather she's all eyes, because she looks at the tiniest things. And when one does not do exactly what she says, she becomes very persistent and demanding and gives you no peace. And so she says the lullaby that she sang to Jesus. Now, there's no need for me to read that. So let's go on to August the 17th, 1899. And here she's talking about the power and the office of holy obedience. So I want to give you a number of scriptures so that I can just continue reading. 2 Corinthians 10, 5. Philippians 2, 8. Ephesians 6, 5. And 2 Corinthians 2, 9. This morning after receiving communion, I was saying to my beloved Jesus, how is it that this virtue of obedience is so demanding and sometimes so strong as to reach the point of being capricious? In other words, heroic obedience was being asked of Louisa. And of course, if you're asked to do something heroic, it costs. It's not called heroic for nothing. And he answered, do you know why this noble lady obedience is as you say? Because she gives death to all vices, because obedience goes against your will. And of course, that was the whole idea of setting up religious life and people taking vows of obedience, that they would be able to overcome their self-will and surrender their wills to God. And therefore, the divine will should have spread like wildfire in all our communities. Unfortunately, it didn't happen. Because obedience gives death to all the vices. And naturally, one has to inflict death upon someone else. Someone who has to do this must be strong and courageous. And if he does not succeed with this, he will use strong caprices to do it. If this is necessary in order to kill the body, which is so fragile, more so is it necessary in order to give death to vices and to one's own passions and emotions. In fact, it's so hard that sometimes the passions seem to be dead and they begin to live again. And so this diligent lady is always in motion and spying continuously. If she sees that the soul raises the slightest difficulty at what is commanded of her, fearing that some vice might begin to live again in her heart, she wages such a war against her and gives her no peace until the soul prostrates herself at her feet and does in mute silence whatever she wants. This is why she is so demanding and almost capricious, as you say. Ah, yes, there's no true peace of soul without obedience. That's something that people nowadays have no understanding of. Because it gets along. Okay, there's no peace of soul without obedience. And if it seems that one may enjoy peace, it's a false peace, because it gets along with one's own passions and never with virtues. And one ends up in ruin because by moving away from obedience, one moves away from God. And we move away from a king that is so noble. Moreover, obedience kills one's own will. And this is the issue in our journey to divine will, that if the self-will is not dealt with, if it's not put aside, if it's not put down, the divine will can't take over. This is the great gift that God is asking of us in the divine will. And so every day we must say, not my will, but thine be done. Not my will, but thine be done. Especially when things go against you. And if the Lord sees that you are sincere about it, he will test it, of course, by letting people go against your will. Obedience kills one's own will and pours the divine will in torrents into it. So much so that one can say that the obedient soul no longer lives of her will, but of the divine. Now, that's exactly what Paul says in Galatians 2:20. I no longer live, Christ lives in me. Can there ever be a life more beautiful, more holy than to live out of the will of God himself? With the other virtues, even the most sublime, there can be love of self, but with obedience, never. And that's the reason why Satan has attacked our religious communities and has killed obedience for fear that any of these people would reach such wonderful heights. So August 18th, 1899. This is about truth. Truth places the soul in order. John 14:6, Jesus said, I am the way, I am the truth, I am the life. This morning, my most beloved Jesus came and I said to him, my beloved Jesus, I believe that everything I write is all nonsense. And he said, my word is not only truth, but also light. That means that what Louisa is writing is Jesus' word. Jesus will confirm this in the higher volumes, that all the teaching in these volumes is his own teaching, his own word. So he said, my word is only truth, but it is also light, that it enlightens us. And when a light enters a dark room, that dark room is our souls and our minds, what does it do? It dispels the darkness and it makes one distinguish the objects that are in it, whether they are ugly or beautiful, whether they are in order or disorder. And from the way the room is found, one judges the person who occupies it. So I want to give you Psalm 119 verses 105 and 140. Your word is light. Okay. Now, Jesus continues, the human life is the dark room. And when the light of truth enters a soul, it dispels the darkness. That is, it makes her distinguish what is true from what is false. In other words, it gives her discernment. Discernment is the ability to distinguish what is true and false. It helps her to discern the temporal from the eternal in such a way that she casts vices away from herself and places the order of virtues within her. Now, before I go any further, I want to give you Psalm 43, verse 3. John 17, verse 17. And Psalm 13, verse 3. And now for the bit that I'm going to read, I want to give you John 8:12 and 1 John 1:5 and Matthew 7:25. In fact, since my light is holy, it is my very divinity. That's the 1 John 1:5. It cannot communicate anything but sanctity and order, because that's what God is. And so the soul feels the light of patience, of humility and charity and the like come out of herself. If my word produces these signs in you, why would you fear? That's also Psalm 27, verse 1 and 2, probably. After this, Jesus let me hear how he was praying to the Father for me, saying, Holy Father, I pray you for this soul. Let it be that she fulfill our most holy will perfectly in everything. Not just fulfill it, but fulfill it completely. Perfectly means complete, that there's nothing missing. Let it be, O adorable Father, that her actions be so conformed to mine that one might not be distinguished from the other, so that I may accomplish what I have designed in her. That's Hebrews 9:25. Sorry, it could be 7:25. But who can say the strength I felt being infused into me by this prayer of Jesus? Now, what Louisa says there proves what these writings say about Jesus' word, that his word is creative, and that when he speaks his word into you, he actually gives you what he says. Let there be light, there was light. Let us create man, he created him. Okay. And so he infused strength into Louisa. And this strength is what we call fortitude, one of the great gifts of God. Louisa said, I felt my soul being clothed with such strength or fortitude that in order to fulfill the most holy will of God, I would not have cared suffering 1,000 martyrdoms if this were what he pleased. May the Lord be always thanked who uses such mercy with this poor sinner. Now, fortitude is the most wonderful, wonderful gift from God. I call it, it's like the steel girders that are put into the skyscrapers to enable them to withstand hurricanes. So I call fortitude the steel girders for your soul that enables you to withstand temptation and trials and difficulties safely. So we now come to August the 21st, 1899. And this is about our motivation. After having spent 2 days of sufferings, my kind Jesus showed himself all affability and sweetness. In my interior, I kept saying, how good the Lord is with me, yet I find nothing in me that might please him. And Jesus answering told me, my beloved, just as you find no other pleasure and contentment than being with me, conversing with me, and pleasing me alone in such a way that all other things that are not mine are disgusting for you, in the same way, my pleasure and my consolation is to come and be with you, to speak with you. You cannot understand the power that a soul who has the sole purpose of pleasing me alone has over my heart in drawing me to herself. I feel so bound to her that I am forced to do what she wants. This is incredible. I want to give you 1 Thessalonians 2:4 and John 8:29. And so here Jesus is saying the power that intercession has when it's done out of the motivation of pure love, that we do it simply for Jesus alone. While Jesus was saying this, I understood that he was speaking in that way because during the past days, while suffering most bitter pains, I kept saying in my interior, my Jesus, everything for love of you. May these pains be as many acts of praise, honour and homage that I offer you. May these pains be many voices that glorify you and as many proofs that tell you that I love you. And there Louisa has shown us what to do with all the things that cost us in our everyday lives, that we ask the Lord to take them as signs of love from us to him, and that we would want to glorify him. So August 22nd, Jesus communicates his virtues to Louisa. So notice now he has been ordering her soul in love, and he's now wanting all of his attributes to be seen in her, which is amazing, according to her size, of course, as a creature. My dear Jesus continues to come all lovable and majestic. While in this appearance, he told me, the purity of my gazes shines on all of your works in such a way, rising again into my eyes, it produces splendor for me and cheers me from the filthy things that other creatures do. Louisa remained all confused at these words, so much so that she did not dare to tell him anything. But Jesus, cheering her up, said, tell me, what do you want? And Louisa said, when I have you, is there anything else I could possibly desire? And Jesus, more than one, asked me again, she said, to tell him what I wanted. And I, gazing upon him, saw the beauty of his virtues and said to him, my most sweet Jesus, give me your virtues. Then Jesus, opening his heart, made many distinct rays come out of his virtues, which entered into my heart, and I felt all of myself being strengthened in his virtues. Then he added, what else do you want? And I remember that during the past days, a pain that I was suffering prevented my senses from dissolving in God, said to him, my kind Jesus, let it be that the pain may not prevent me from dissolving myself in you. Now, dissolving yourself in him means that you enter deeply into contemplation so that your soul communicates with him in silence. But that silence is pure love. And Jesus touching me with his hand, the part of me that was suffering mitigated the bitterness of the spasm in such a way that I can recollect and dissolve myself in him. So August the 27th, 1899, the effect of Jesus going to a soul. This morning while seeing my sweet Jesus, I felt a fear in me that it might not be him but the devil to deceive me. And Jesus answering my fear told me, when I am the one that goes to a soul, all of her interior powers are annihilated and recognize their nothingness. Okay, this is a very important thing that Jesus is telling us, okay? When we have an authentic visit from God, we go into our absolute nothingness and recognize his allness. When the devil approaches us, he puffs you up in pride. Before the all-holy God, we see our nothingness. A very good example of this is in Isaiah chapter 6, verses 1 to 8. Isaiah was a good man, a holy man, and he was serving God as a prophet. But when he had the vision of the glory of God in the temple, he immediately said, I am undone. I'm a wretched man and I belong to a wretched people. What am I going to do? And he allowed himself then to be purified and to be sent to the people as a messenger. And Jesus said, when I see the soul humiliated, make my love overabound with many streams in such a way as to inundate her and strengthen her in good. It's all the opposite when it comes from the devil. So when the Lord sees that we throw ourselves into our nothingness and acknowledge our nothingness before him, he creates out of nothing. So he can work with that and he can pour his love in. But of course, if we're puffed up with self-importance, which is totally stupid, he can do nothing because that's that's actually blocking his ability to work with us. So now in August the 30th, 1899, Jesus says that man has lost religion. So I want to give you Amos 3:7 here, because Amos said that the Lord never does anything without telling the prophets first. And he always tells them so that they will intercede for their people. This morning, my beloved Jesus transported me outside of myself and made me see the decadence of religion. Now, don't forget that this is due to the fact that atheistic materialism was declared in France after the French Revolution. And now Marxist communism is being launched on the world as well. So this is the deterioration in religion that has happened since then. And we're living at a time when the very bitter fruits of that are being seen in the church today. He made me see the decadence of religion in men and the preparation for war. I said to him, O Lord, in what a heart-rending state the world finds itself in these times, in the things of religion. It seems that she who ennobles man and makes him aspire to an eternal purpose is no longer recognized by the world. She who ennobles man is religion. But that which makes one cry the most is that religion is ignored by some of the very ones who call themselves religious, who should lay down their lives to defend her and revive her. In other words, the priests and bishops and cardinals of the church and the religious. And Jesus, assuming a most afflicted look, told me, my daughter, this is why man lives like a beast. He has lost religion. But even sadder times will come for man because of the blindness in which he has immersed himself. But that blindness is this materialistic communism, atheistic communism and materialism and so on. So even sadder times will come because of the blindness in which man has immersed himself, so much so that my heart aches in seeing him. But the blood which I will cause to be shed by every kind of people, religious and worldly, will revive this holy religion and will water the rest of the people grown wild that will be left. And by civilizing them once again, it will restore their nobility. Here is the necessity for blood to be shed and for churches themselves to be almost destroyed. Now, here you've got a look into the destruction that was going to happen to religion in the 20th century. I want to give you Hosea 4:6. I want to give you Matthew 15, verses 1 to 8. And I want to give you Matthew 23. Also, if you look at the book of Judges in the Old Testament, that's when religion broke down and the people of God went into absolute decay. And at the very end of the book of Judges, you're told that every man did what he thought fit in those days. That's absolute chaos. Can you imagine trying to travel on a motorway if every driver was making his own rules, his or her rules? Notice that Jesus says that religion civilizes us. It ennobles us. It raises us up. And when we cast it aside, then we go back and civilization deteriorates, as we're seeing right now. So this is the reason for blood to be shed. In other words, wars. And for churches themselves to be almost destroyed. In other words, there has to be persecution, so that they may be restored anew and exist in their original prestige and splendour. But who can say the cruel havoc they will wreak on them in the times to come? I visited the great cathedral of St. Catherine in St. Petersburg after the fall of the wall. And it was very sad to see one of the greatest of the church buildings in Russia had been reduced to a storehouse. And in order to celebrate Mass now, they had to put a tent inside of it because the building had been, the external walls were still there, but there was no semblance of a church. I think they've restored it by now. Also, you need to know that during the destruction of religion in the Soviet Union, there were more martyrs in the 20th, also in Europe, of course, there were more martyrs in the 20th century than in the 19th centuries before that added together. But who can say the cruel havoc that will wreak on them in the times to come? I will let it pass in silence because I don't remember very well and I don't see it very clearly. If the Lord wants me to talk about it, he will give me more clarity and then I will take the pen again, but I'm going to stop here. Now, from August the 31st, 1899, the priest puts Louisa under an absolutely terrifying obedience. And the next long section is about that. I'll have to do it in two pieces. So the confessor gives Louisa the obedience not to speak to Jesus and to reject him. Now, she's been told by Jesus that she must obey. No matter what, she must obey. And this is the cruelest stroke of all. So this is self-abnegation and self-denial at an absolutely heroic level because her soul screams for him when he's not there. After the confessor gave me the obedience that when Jesus would come, I was to say, I cannot speak, move away. I took it as a joke, not as a formal obedience. So when Jesus came, almost neglecting the order I received, I dared to say to him, my good Jesus, look at what the priest wants to do. She couldn't believe it. And he said, daughter, abnegation, that's self-denial. And Louisa said, but Lord, this is a serious thing. This is about having to not want you. How can I do this? You have to put there Luke 23:42, where Jesus said, not my will, but thine be done, O Lord. For the second time, Jesus said, abnegation. But Lord, what are you saying? Louisa said, do you perhaps know that I can be without you? For the third time, he said, daughter, abnegation, and he disappeared. Louisa said, what can I say how I felt in seeing Jesus wanting me to dispose myself for this obedience? And then from September the 1st, this cruel, cruel struggle that Louisa has starts. And as far as she's concerned, it's a test too far. Nearly costs her life. But it's the heroic test that proves that she would do anything for obedience. When the confessor came, he asked me if I had done the obedience. And after I told him how things had gone, he renewed the obedience that for no reason was I to converse with Jesus, my sole and only comfort, and that I was to drive him away if he came. And so having understood that what was given to me was a true obedience, in my interior I said, fiat voluntas tua, also in this. But how much it costs me, this is cruel martyrdom. I feel I have a nail stuck inside my heart which pierces it through. And since the heart is used to asking and longing for Jesus continuously, so much so that just as the breathing and the heartbeat are continuous, so it seems to me that my desiring and wanting my only good is continuous. Wanting to prevent this would be like wanting to prevent somebody from breathing or to prevent his heart from palpitating. How could anyone live? Yet one must let obedience prevail. Oh God, what pain, what atrocious torture. How to prevent the heart from asking for its very life. How to stop it. The will applied itself with all its strength in order to hold it. But since great vigilance was needed continuously, from time to time it would become tired and discouraged, and the heart would make its escape asking for Jesus. In noticing this, the will would apply itself with greater strength in order to stop it, but no, it would often lose the battle. Therefore, it seemed to me that I was doing continuous acts of disobedience. In what contrasts, in what a bloody war, what mortal agonies my poor heart suffered. I found myself in such constraints and in such sufferings that I felt my life was leaving me. Yet, had I been able to die, it would have been a comfort for me. But no, and what is more, I felt the pains of death without being able to die. I'm going to stop there and I will take it up in the next section.